Today we are joined by Dr. Michael Parsons, a board-certified clinical neuropsychologist and faculty member at the Harvard Medical School in the Pappas Neuro-Oncology Center and the Department of Psychiatry at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Parsons specializes in the area of cognitive assessment and advanced brain imaging techniques to understand how cancer affects neural systems and the efficacy of treatment for these factors. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Parsons.
Thanks for having me.
In some settings, neuropsychologists have moved from consultants to working within multidisciplinary teams. Can you speak to the roles that neuropsychologists have in evaluating patients with brain tumors in working within a brain tumor clinic?
Sure, that's a great question. You know, the role of a neuropsychologist in a brain tumor team, I think, is somewhat unique in comparison to other multidisciplinary groups that I've worked in throughout my career. And part of what makes it unique, honestly, is the complexity of cancer. The fact is that as neuropsychologists, we do not get very good exposure in our training to the medical issues that are present for cancer patients. And in brain tumors specifically, we haven't done a very good job as a field of building in a reasonable understanding of the different types of brain tumors, the time course over which they evolve, the issues that the patients face, and all of those factors have a bearing on what our role as neuropsychologists is in their multidisciplinary care. So in order to answer the question, you really have to start by breaking down the concept of brain tumors into multiple different diagnostic entities. Starting with gliomas, which are the second most common form of primary brain tumor, and probably the area in which we're most often called on to consult, the role of the neuropsychologist really can occur at multiple stages in the patient's process. Oftentimes, I'll be called upon in working with a patient with a low-grade glioma to meet and evaluate the patient after they're initially found to have a mass that is suspected to be a low-grade glioma. In that case, I'm working with the patient to identify whether or not there are any deficits at that point in time that might have a bearing on surgical decision-making. You might think that in the context of a brain tumor, there really isn't much decision-making to do about surgery, but in fact, there is. And the relevance of surgery for the outcome of the patient, both in terms of their overall survival and their cognitive outcome, varies quite widely. So a patient, for instance, who has a tumor in a language-related area or a memory-related area might have at baseline almost no cognitive impairment and thereby be at risk for some significant deficits if a really aggressive surgical approach were taken. So consulting on that kind of case and talking with the surgeons and the team is often a part of what I do at baseline. Then later in the course of treatment, perhaps prior to or after a radiation treatment or a course of chemotherapy, my role in the evaluation and consultation for a patient might take on more of a rehabilitation type of angle where there are known deficits and the issue is how to help the patients cope with those, make decisions about their daily life in terms of work or return to school or dealing with challenges in their home environment, just like dealing with any other neurologic disorder. So in those kind of examples, the role is really working with a multidisciplinary team and trying to provide input to the patient's overall care that has a bearing on their outcome and quality of life. Sometimes they're medical decision-making as well.
So it sounds like these are patients that you follow over a long term?
Whenever possible, yes. The main impediment to that is that sometimes, for instance, in a tertiary medical center kind of setting, our patients come to us for a particular specialist like a surgeon or a radiation oncologist at one critical juncture in their treatment. And then they may return to their home area, wherever that is, for sort of longer term care. And so if possible, I tend to try to initially evaluate patients as early as possible after their diagnosis and treatment begins, and then on a periodic basis thereafter, depending on their diagnosis and their disease course.
And you mentioned that in training, neuropsychology students and trainees don't often have much exposure to the complex medical issues that patients with brain tumors face. Can you speak a little bit about what some of these complex medical issues might be?
Sure. So, some of the issues have to do with the prognosis and expected course of the different types of brain tumors. So, for example, I think many times when we as neuropsychologists and certainly our students and trainees hear brain tumor, you sort of automatically make an assumption about a highly aggressive disease that's likely to be terminal within some relatively short number of years or something like that. And there are some times where that's exactly accurate. But other times, of course, there are gliomas that occur where the median life expectancy is greater than 15 years. And so understanding the specifics of the brain tumor diagnosis, which has to do with genetic variants, World Health Organization classification criteria, and a number of demographic characteristics of the individual, is sort of the first step in understanding what is this person likely to experience and how does that affect what my role is in their care. Also then the different treatments that a brain tumor patient is exposed to, whether those are chemotherapy agents or radiation treatments or even surgery and some other adjunctive kind of treatments that are on board now, have pretty widely varying potential cognitive consequences. So, for example, radiation therapy, which is sort of the mainstay of treatment for a lot of brain tumors, carries with it the risk of significant cognitive side effects. But that risk depends on how the radiation treatment is delivered. That could be, for instance, whether the radiation is delivered to the whole brain versus whether it's a more focal form of radiation called intensity modulated radiation therapy or stereotactic radiosurgery. It also relates to the type of particle that's used in radiation therapy, whether it's delivery of photon radiation, which is the most commonly used radiation therapy modality, or proton radiation, which allows for a more targeted radiation field. So there's these variations in treatment that you need to understand because they relate directly to the risk of cognitive consequences of those things. And then there are all the genetic variations in the tumor itself, which is just this incredible alphabet soup of abbreviations that when you first start hearing about it is completely overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's a lot to weigh, and I was wondering how patients with brain metastasis, what are some of the factors that are weighed in terms of the treatment decisions that are given, or some of the treatment decisions given the impact on cognition, both with the treatment itself and the tumor itself that it can have on the patient?
Yeah, it becomes a very individualized discussion. A lot of that relates to the expected course, again, of the brain tumor. The likely influence of how effective the treatment might be for that tumor. In other words, if you have a treatment that's likely to have a high degree of toxicity and cognitive side effects, but it also has a very high chance of stopping tumor growth and making a meaningful change in a person's life expectancy, then most people would opt to take their chances and get the treatment and deal with the cognitive consequences when they come. However, if the treatment efficacy is a little bit less well established and the physician can only give them, modest hopes in terms of how much time it's going to give them or how likely it is to stop the tumor growth, then people may really opt to choose quality of life over quantity and say, look, I really don't want the toxicity of that treatment if I know the difference in life expectancy is only going to be some small amount of time. I'd rather have a better chance of having that be good time. And of course, as you said, the tumor itself, by virtue of its progression, can induce a lot of symptoms that are difficult to predict for an individual. It's a difficult discussion, but the opportunity to be involved in that discussion and help inform patients about the cognitive and behavioral side of things is one that I think neuropsychologists is really perfectly positioned to make.
What are some factors in which the neuropsychological evaluation would suggest contraindication to surgical or treatment candidacy?
Well, with regard to surgery, and I can't profess to be the complete expert on this topic, there are variants of glioma, for example, that depending on their size and location may or may not lead to much difference in outcome from a resection. Or perhaps, for instance, in oligodendrogliomas, if the resection, the tumor is in an area where at most a partial resection is going to be achieved, either because it's involved with blood vessels, or it's right in motor control regions or speech output regions, and they know they're only going to be able to get, say, 50% of the tumor out, then the difference between getting only a biopsy versus getting that 50% out may not be very much in terms of the patient's overall outcome. In those situations, if the neuropsychological evaluation and the overall picture would predict a high risk of cognitive morbidity from the surgery, the overall decision of the patient and the treatment team may be to take a very conservative approach to surgery and not risk the cognitive morbidity. So, for example, I had a patient a few weeks ago who had previously had a brain tumor, a low-grade glioma, resected several years ago, and the tumor has now shown some new growth. And the new growth is occurring right in the body of the hippocampus on the left. She's already had part of her left temporal lobe resected, and she's very high-functioning, running a business and completely fluent, good memory in her day-to-day life, and in her 40s, very, very much mid-career and a high-powered executive type of woman. The question was whether to resect the left hippocampus that appeared to be infiltrated by tumor. And when I evaluated her overall cognitive functioning, we found that her memory is completely intact, verbal memory scores in the average range, even though she was tested in her second language. So in that situation, I felt obliged to point out that I thought there was substantial risk to her verbal memory if that left hippocampus were resected. We then went on to do a WADA test with her, which unfortunately did not go well, and we were unable to get useful information from the WADA. Ultimately, the surgeon decided to resect only a small portion of the tumor, which was more in left lateral temporal cortex, to get a diagnosis, and left the hippocampal tissue intact with a goal to treat that subsequently with radiation therapy and chemotherapy, to which she's responded well in the past. So in that situation, after kind of extensive testing and consultation with the patient, the decision was made to choose a more conservative treatment with surgery and use treatments that have a slightly lower likelihood, at least immediately, of causing significant memory loss.
So it sounds like in this case, this was a really helpful case to highlight what her strengths were in her memory and the potential hit she could take through the surgical resection.
Exactly. And our presence on the team allowed us to sort of facilitate a discussion in a multidisciplinary way with the surgeon and the radiation oncologist and the neuro-oncologist and the patient to talk about what her priorities are, what we can say about the risk, what we don't know about the risk, and both in terms of surgery and in terms of minimizing surgery. So it was a complex discussion, but I think overall the patient was very pleased with the outcome when she came out of surgery and is, moving forward with additional treatment now. And, hopefully we'll have as good an outcome as possible under the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. You recently published a chapter in the Physician's Field Guide to Neuropsychology Collaboration through Case Example Neurosurgery for Meningioma, where you gave examples of patients with different presentations based on the location and history of their meningioma. I was really struck not only by the complexities of these patients, but also how their neuropsychological profiles didn't necessarily appear to localize well. I was wondering if you could speak to what some of the challenges are in differentiating between patients who may have mild cognitive impairment, say related to cerebrovascular risk factors, compared to those who have a tumor that may impact similar kind of frontal subcortical circuitry.
Interesting. I think that one of the challenges that came out in that chapter had to do with, as you're implying, some of the meningiomas that affect the frontal lobes. Meningiomas have a predisposition to grow in a location known as the orbital groove, which is basically on the cribriform plate immediately inferior to the medial frontal lobes. And when they grow in that location, they tend to compress the brain. Meningiomas are generally slow-growing, common tumors that do not invade the brain necessarily, at least at their more benign grades, but they do compress brain tissue pretty significantly and can reach really tremendous size. When they grow in that location, what they tend to impact are the orbitofrontal cortices of the medial forebrain, and they're not destroying tissue so much as interfering with its function through compression and edema. And so what often appears is that the presentation of these patients takes on a very behavioral characteristic, often either in the form of a kind of apathy, ebullia, loss of initiation, or sometimes, though less frequently, the opposite, more of disinhibited, impulsive, good old Phineas Gage kind of presentation. That differs from what we see in frontal subcortical vascular disease because it's less likely to impact the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and its connections to the basal ganglia. And therefore, we don't tend to see as much of the common working memory impairment or attentional impairment or memory encoding impairment with the meningiomas as we do in a classic frontal subcortical MCI kind of picture. So the trick is that, as you said, there are times where the neuropsychological evaluation itself will be kind of unrevealing, and a person will look pretty normal on their testing. Mostly that's because in the setting of testing, we provide a great deal of structure and initiative that sometimes masks these more behavioral characteristics of a frontal lobe lesion. So in those situations, you're left to really put on your neurobehavioral hat, listen to the history as reported to you from family or other collateral sources, and acknowledge that even though you might not be able to see much of an impairment on testing, you have a neurobehavioral picture that's consistent with this lesion location. And, we fortunately, as one of those cases in that chapter described, have seen some pretty positive outcomes from meningioma surgery regarding those symptoms. Especially in grade 1 meningiomas, once you remove the mass and reduce the compression of the surrounding cortex, behavior can often return to a much more normal state. I had a patient just a couple of weeks ago where this kind of behavioral presentation had progressed for 2 or 3 years, during which time she had multiple psychiatric admissions. She had stopped caring for herself in even the most basic ways, not even bothering to get up to go to the toilet. And her family had been told she was demented and had a behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia. Fortunately, a very astute physician assistant who saw her on admission to the psychiatric unit ordered brain imaging. They found a huge orbital frontal meningioma, which was resected. And when I met them a few weeks ago, her husband said to me, yep, she's back just like she used to be. I don't know if she's 100% cognitively, but she certainly had a dramatic improvement from removal of that tumor.
That's really interesting, because as you were talking, I was thinking about the complexities and kind of similarities with patients that have the FTLD, more behavioral variant presentation, and how challenging that must be for people who are of a younger age of onset, in which we typically think around the FTLD age, and somebody who, you know, may have a slow-growing meningioma.
It's certainly a concern, and the fact is that meningiomas are common. They occur in the same age range as FTD, and because they have a predilection for that location, at minimum, when you see a striking behavioral change and you hear a convincing story for that, even without a clear, you know, executive function type of picture on your cognitive testing, I encourage people to at least consider a CT scan if it hasn't already been done, because you don't want to miss that diagnosis, and it can respond to treatment in impressive and dramatic ways.
Mm-hmm. Most of the patients that neuropsychologists see have very complex medical and, in some cases, mental health histories. What are some of the psychological factors that are critical to assess in these evaluations?
You know, one thing that struck me about working with the brain tumor patients specifically is how resilient the average person in that overall patient cluster tends to be. It's one of the reasons I love working with this population, quite honestly. The reality is that brain tumors and cancer in general affects people with all kinds of psychological makeups. And the majority of people out there who happen to get this kind of cancer or others are pretty psychologically healthy. And so one of the really enjoyable things about working with these patients is you get to work with psychologically healthy people who are dealing with a tremendous unexpected stressor. And as a psychologist, that gives you a lot to work with. You know, sometimes in working with our more severely disturbed or chronic mental illness populations, it's difficult to feel like you have a lot you can offer from a mental health point of view, where you know there are chronic issues that are really characterological and difficult to address. Whereas in this population, more often than not, what you're dealing with is a acute stressor that can be addressed through some pretty straightforward cognitive behavioral therapies or just some support and understanding. There certainly are a variety of adjustment conditions, as you would expect with such a severe and frightening diagnosis, and being able to understand those, recognize those for what they are, provide recommendations or interventions to assist with that is a key part of pretty much every evaluation that you would do in the brain tumor population. There are also interesting and complex behavioral and psychological changes that can come about as a primary symptom of the tumor itself, or of the treatment in kind of a focal way. So for instance, seeing patients who present with a lot of manic symptoms or lose some of their ability to interpret social cues in interpersonal settings. And in those situations, providing a neurobehavioral framework for the patient and family to understand those symptoms, and sometimes providing some intervention or feedback at least for them in order to give some corrective strategies and understanding what to expect and how to manage that problem going forward can often be helpful. And then, of course, there is the overlap between cancer diagnosis and more mainstream kind of DSM diagnosis mental illness. So cancer occurs in people with mental health and people with mental illness. And in anyone who has a premorbid mental health condition, you can imagine that the addition of a brain tumor diagnosis is a tremendous stressor, will tend to lead to exacerbation of premorbid symptoms, particularly if they're in the anxiety and mood disorder realm. And really, in order to achieve a satisfying outcome and a decent quality of life for the patient with brain tumor, the mental health issues need to be addressed first and foremost, right along with the brain tumor issues themselves. In fact, many patients who do have a dual diagnosis situation, in other words, a brain tumor diagnosis and a mental health diagnosis, end up having a greater impact of the mental health diagnosis in terms of their quality of life, even after effective treatment of the brain tumor diagnosis. In fact, I just finished seeing a patient today who has a long-standing history of anxiety disorders, and unfortunately, right around the same time she was diagnosed with brain tumor, had discovered the suicide of a close family member, was diagnosed with a brain tumor in the same week, and has really struggled for 2 years since then with what, from all appearances, are classical PTSD symptoms, and now is just getting engaged with a cognitive behavioral therapist specialized in trauma to address those issues. She's had a very good outcome from a brain tumor point of view, has had successful treatment, and had 2 years of no recurrence of tumor on her scan, but her life is miserable related to this classical anxiety disorder.
Are there certain features that suggest more favorable prognostic outcomes for patients undergoing multimodality treatments for brain tumors?
Absolutely. You know, again, let's just take glioma as the most sort of straightforward example. The most relevant diagnostic feature, which has really just emerged in the past decade or so, is a specific mutation that predisposes some patients to gliomagenesis. And that is mutation in a gene that codes for something called IDH1, which is the acronym for isocitrate dehydrogenase. Patients who have a mutation in the IDH1 gene tend to have a much slower course of progression and longer overall life expectancy from their tumor. It also has been shown to relate to cognitive symptomatology, where patients with the IDH1 mutation, as compared with those who do not have the IDH mutation in their glioma, are less likely to have cognitive symptoms. The thought behind this is that the tumors tend to be more slow growing and potentially provide more opportunity for brain reorganization as they slowly grow and infiltrate surrounding tissue than do the more aggressive and fast growing non-mutated tumors. It's also the case that a number of individual difference variables predict outcome, both from the brain tumor perspective and from a cognitive perspective. Some of those are the ones you would expect. For instance, younger age, higher cognitive reserve, those sorts of things predict better outcome overall. There are also recently discovered additional, what we call germline genetic factors, or in other words, genetic variables of the individual, not of the tumor, that predict better outcome from a cognitive point of view. Denise Correa at Sloan Kettering in New York City has published a paper showing that some of the genetic variants that predict cognitive outcome in other neurologic diseases, including APOE, BDNF, COMT, are also predictive of the risk for cognitive outcome in patients with gliomas. So we're understanding more and more that, you know, with brain tumor, it's not just about where the tumor is, which is, of course, an important predictor of cognitive risk, but it's also a number of other characteristics that predict who's likely to struggle in the context of a brain tumor from a cognitive perspective, and which patients have a better chance of doing well.
So this is a nice segue into talking about a paper that you have that's in press currently, the Assessment and Management of Cognitive Changes in Patients with Cancer. And you mentioned future directions, including biomarkers. Are there specific biomarkers? It sounds like you've mentioned a few here with genetic markers that have been identified. Are there specific biomarkers that are being targeted in things like brain imaging and genetics to better understand these outcomes and patient risk?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really complex area. So just to be clear, that paper and a lot of this work really applies primarily to cancers that do not directly affect the central nervous system, or so-called non-CNS cancers. And in those situations, what we're looking at are the cognitive effects of a non-CNS cancer, in other words, having cancer somewhere in your body, and the cognitive effects of treatment for that, usually meaning chemotherapy, but sometimes also meaning things like a radiation to the body or hormonal therapies and other things like that. So, you know, in comparison to patients with a brain tumor per se, in general terms, most of the patients who develop cognitive problems in the context of a non-CNS cancer have a milder pattern of cognitive impairment. That's not always the case. There are a small subset of patients who seem to develop really progressive, rapidly deteriorating dementias after treatment with chemotherapy. And understanding whether or not treatment for cancer has somehow accelerated their aging process is one of the hottest topics in the so-called chemo brain world right now. And that really gets to the biomarkers question. You know, the short answer to the question is we don't know if there are individual difference factors that would, say, put an older person at risk to develop dementia if they get chemotherapy. But we really need to know that. There are a number of studies going on right now to address that kind of question. Many of them in clinical trials to look at different potential drugs or therapy agents to ameliorate those cognitive symptoms. We believe that APOE may play a role in that risk, but it's not a clear-cut picture. In other words, having an APOE4 allele, for example, does not necessarily predispose people to develop cognitive problems after chemotherapy. There have been two papers on this question, and the findings have been a little bit mixed. The issue of other genetic risk factors is being explored. The question of whether there may be imaging biomarkers, such as differences in functional connectivity that would predict risk for cognitive difficulty is also being explored. And I think it's also important to consider the individual difference risk factors that we know matter in other neurologic disease, such as risk for cerebrovascular disease and cognitive reserve and things like that. So a lot of those issues are just now starting to be explored, and we really don't know whether we'll be able to come up with a clear-cut group of biomarkers that would predict risk for cognitive decline in non-CNS cancers.
Dr. Michael Parsons is a faculty member at Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks again for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.